From WEKU on the campus of Eastern Kentucky University, welcome to Eastern Standard, produced with the support of One, the Alltech Ideas Conference, and Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin, and in this hour, we welcome another new content partner, the Lexington-based nonprofit online cultural affairs magazine Undermain, interviewing the new interim director of the Lexington Art League, Matt Collinsworth. Longtime public and media relations pro Phil Osborne also has some political chops. He pulls it all together in his self-published book, Flight 668, a fiction about the seamier side of Kentucky's political culture. We talk with Lexington fashion designer slash activist Sarita Benedict Begley. But we get started with an excerpt from a recent article in Forbes magazine. Here's how it begins. Imagine a sweater softer than anything you've ever felt before and more durable than cotton. Imagine a car built with something lighter than steel that could stand 10 times the impact without denting. Imagine if you could save 4 acres of trees by making paper from a single acre of a rapid-growing plant instead. Imagine biodegradable Legos. Now imagine all this possibility actually exists, but you can't enjoy any of it, because people in power once decided the plant from which it's all derived has a scorned cousin named marijuana. If you can wrap your mind around this dereliction of logic, only then can you begin to understand the painfully silly policies America's had in place that have kept hemp from coating our farmland with hues of pale yellow and light green. Well, the silliness described in that Forbes article was not lost on Cave City industrial hemp grower Chad Wilson, a recent guest on NPR's On Point.
It's really insane that we was the only developed country, that was not growing industrial hemp, yet we were importing billions of dollars of industrial hemp to be sold in the United States.
Unlike its biological cousin marijuana, hemp has myriad industrial uses and does not produce a high if ingested. The silliness or insanity, whatever you want to call it, disappeared on the 20th of December when an $867 billion omnibus farm bill was signed into law, legalizing hemp as an agricultural commodity and removing it from the controlled substances list. Championed on the Senate floor by Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, the new law means it's now legal to grow it, make things out of it, and to consume it.
It also allows hemp researchers to apply for competitive federal grants from the U.S. Department of Agriculture and made hemp eligible for crop insurance. Together, these features will encourage new opportunities for struggling farmers and their families, new products for use in construction, healthcare, and manufacturing, and new jobs in a broad range of fields.
Politico reporter Catherine Boudreau, also appearing on that recent edition of On Point, said McConnell even put himself on a key Senate committee to make sure that this happened.
This has been a priority of his for a number of years, and he considers it a potential economic boon for Kentucky, rural Kentucky, you know, farmers who formerly grew tobacco, for instance, or are looking for a more lucrative crop to grow during a time of low commodity prices right now. So that's definitely why he's been kind of passionate about this, about legalizing it.
You may have heard Senator McConnell mention crop insurance. Well, that meant a lot to Chad Wilson, the Cave City industrial hemp grower. Before the farm bill became law, he was not able to buy coverage for his crop.
Unfortunately, no, we weren't. And I became a product of the very thing that we needed last year. I planted my crops according to the weather, like we always do. And unfortunately, the weatherman was wrong. And I lost hemp seeds. High CBD hemp seeds are quite expensive right now. And I lost quite a bit of money, income off the farm due to weather washing me out. And what was ironic, it was the very day that I spoke with another TV host about why we needed Farm Bill. And we planted, and then that night, I became the very thing that I needed. I had all of my seeds wash out in the field, and it hurt us last year.
Kirsten Bonert joins us to talk about what hemp legalization means in Kentucky. Kirsten represents Kentucky Hempsters. And if you would first, Kirsten, give us an elevator pitch about what Kentucky Hempsters do.
Sure, Tom. Thanks for having me. I am co-founder of Kentucky Hempsters, a group that explores the past and present of Kentucky hemp. We do anything from lobbying to hemp events to managing a historic hemp trail. We do a little bit of everything.
And you've spent about the past 5 years
lobbying for what we're about to talk about, among other things, correct?
Yes.
And that is, as 2018 came to a close, Congress passed the Big Farm Bill. It included the legalization of hemp growing across the United States for the first time in more than 80 years. And I've heard it argued that hemp prohibition has, for all these decades, suppressed jobs for farmers, products for consumers, medicine, maybe, for patients. Now that prohibition is a thing of the past, what are the implications for Kentucky farmers, processors, and manufacturers?
Well, already with the passing, we're seeing the industry growing literally. The Kentucky Department of Agriculture actually saw a 400% increase in applications for both processors and farmers this year.
Right after the passage?
Right after. Well, it was right on the line. Everybody was expecting it. So I think, it was a 400% increase, over 1,000 applicants this year compared to under 300 in the past. So right off the bat, we're seeing that happen. In addition to that, companies that have been in the hemp space for several years now are going to see increased investment. There's going to be banking opportunities opened up, as well as crop insurance for farmers. And in addition to that, even grant opportunities, funding opportunities that weren't available before because of hemp's federal illegality.
So this opened up a spigot of financial support that hadn't been there for decades.
Definitely.
What sorts of hemp farming initiatives are now going on in Kentucky? And of course, what you just implied is that we're going to see a lot more, but what's happening right now?
As hemp products are being demanded more, farmers are going to start growing more hemp. There's no specific initiative. The Kentucky Hemp Pilot Program is going to continue. Farmers still have to get licenses to grow, but there will be more processors seeking those inputs for their products. So I expect to see more farmers contracted by processors and manufacturers to get that product to market.
For a lot of years, we heard about hemp products that were derived from the fiber, but what seems to have taken the lead now is demand for CBD, cannabidiol.
Yes.
And there are projections that the cannabidiol market could come close to $600 million this year and could skyrocket into the billions in the next 2 or 3 years as a result of the Farm Bill's passage. It's been proven, CBD, to help with certain kinds of epilepsy. It's been labeled, but not proven, as a cure-all for everything from treating anxiety and depression to menstrual pain, arthritis, PTSD. It can also be found in coffee, beer, and skincare products, and people are even giving it to their pets. But what about applications of hemp fiber? Is response to the demand for CBD oils crowding out the market and making it difficult for farmers to meet demand for hemp fiber products?
Farmers are going to grow what's going to make them money. Like in 2017, CBD took up about 60% of the total program. So farmers and processors, that was about 60% of the focus, while fiber was about 10%. CBD is going to continue to take over the market while that demand's there for the farmers to make that money. And I believe until that market stabilizes, it will be a very prominent focus of those involved in the industry. However, the fiber applications are real, and they've been proven time and time again, not just today with the pilot program, but throughout history. And I think that with the legality of hemp, people being investors will pay more attention to that and be more willing to invest into those applications. There's already companies that are in Kentucky that have been functioning as part of the pilot program, I believe going on 5-6 years now, that have adopted hemp fiber processing among other organic biocomposite processing from other sustainable plants. And so I believe they'll have increased investment and those types of things, and that will only grow too. But CBD will definitely have the focus of the industry until there's another reason to move it elsewhere.
And so really hard to say right now how demand is going to impact pricing. For example, a small bottle of CBD oil, which is typically mixed with coconut oil for flavoring, I suppose, goes for about $45. Which is pretty expensive. That's for about a month's worth.
You're getting it pretty cheap.
Is that right?
Yes. I was at the store the other day and was looking at bottles for $120. What you really have to look at is where it's produced, how many milligrams are in the total product opposed to the serving size. And that's really how the price is going to fluctuate. it's easy right now for people to be charged quite a bit for maybe what it's not worth because of the hype as well and the lack of availability of the product.
And hype is important because we really don't know scientifically yet what the benefits truly are.
And you can't claim very many benefits in the nutraceutical industry, so we always have to watch out for that.
So that got CBD oil producers in a little bit of trouble recently with Facebook. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so oddly enough, Facebook has been removing pages after the legalization of hemp through the Farm Bill. Several of our friends that own companies have had trouble. Some have gotten their pages back. Others are still kind of in that Facebook limbo messaging. You have to deal with the Facebook robots for a minute, and then I think you get to some actual people. But luckily here in Kentucky, we have the support of our representatives and our Commissioner of Agriculture, Ryan Quarles. He wrote a statement, a letter to Mark Zuckerberg requesting that Facebook quit picking on the farmers. You know, they're just trying to make a living.
You and your partner in the Kentucky Hempsters, Alyssa Erickson, have been working at this for about 5 years with a lot of lobbying, a lot of marketing, as you said. Now, hemp production has been legalized. Hemp farming has been legalized. What are you going to do now?
Well, it's been a whirlwind of 5 years. This definitely has taken less time than we thought it would. Now that the work has been done getting hemp legalized, we're going to transition more into education still needed. So we're going to transition into the legal industry with education still in mind. We have a few announcements that we're excited to make in the coming months. I'm not ready to spill my secrets just yet, but we are definitely still going to be engaging our audience. We wouldn't have been able to do the things we have already done without them. We're going to continue our Heritage Hemp Trail and our other historic endeavors here in Central Kentucky, in addition to transitioning Kentucky Hempsters a little bit away from the two of us being the Hempsters and opening it up for a community of Kentucky Hempsters.
So anybody that wants to become a Hempster, look you up, right?
Yes.
And tell us about that trail quickly.
Sure. So we work with a number of historical sites across Kentucky. Right now, we have about 20 sites on our map. We currently grow at Ashland Henry Clay Estate and Waveland here in Lexington, Farmington in Louisville, and Whitehall in Richmond, Kentucky. And what it is a self-guided tour through Kentucky's hemp history. You can pick up your maps at Visit Lex. We have them on hand at different sites, and it's on our website, www.kyhempsters.com.
Kirsten Bonert, one half of Kentucky Hempsters. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
The new Farm Bill imposes a 10-year ban on people with drug-related felonies from working in the hemp industry. It allows farmers already growing hemp under existing research authority to continue their operations. The bill does not include a provision supported by Senator Chuck Grassley, an Iowa Republican, that would have prevented wealthy absentee landlords from collecting farm subsidies. We'll be back in a moment with Phil Osborne on his new book, Flight 668, and Lexington fashion designer and activist Sarita Benedict-Begley. Later in the hour, our new arts partner, Undermain. You're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Eastern Standard is made possible by One, the Alltech Ideas Conference, a global nexus of innovation for the future of food and the farm. Attendees are future thinkers who view technology as a transformative opportunity for their businesses and lives. They share a belief in the boundless power of just one idea to change everything. The 35th Annual Conference, 119, is May 19th through 21st, 2019, in Lexington. Learn more at one.alltech.com.
Major support for Eastern Standard on WEKU is provided by the law firm Hicks & Funson. Kentucky lawyers Josh Hicks, Greg Funson, and Shannon Church provide legal advice and representation in the areas of personal injury, catastrophic accident, and immigration law. Learn more at hfkylawyers.com.
You're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU. I'm Tom Martin. I'm talking with Sarita Benedict Begley, a Lexington fashion designer who brings a unique background and perspective to the art and business of fashion. She is among a group of designers, photographers, and models who created the Lexington Fashion Collaborative, and she has a special event coming up later in this month of January. Thanks for joining us, Sarita.
Well, thank you for having me, Tom. It's my pleasure.
And briefly, if you could, in a nutshell, if that's possible, tell us about the events in your life that brought you to Lexington, Kentucky.
Well, the main event was getting married to an American. I grew up in an area in Honduras that's very remote and was well known for being the location for many cultural and biological research, environmental research as well. And my husband is an archaeologist, so he was working there and I was working there. We met and got married and moved to Lexington, and it's been almost 20 years.
Your development as a fashion designer, are you self-taught? Did you go to school for that?
When it comes to the creative part, which is the designing part, I was self-taught. And I always say that I was born a designer, that I've been doing this my entire life, ever since I was little. If you talk to somebody who met me when I was 6, 7, they will tell you, yeah, we could tell that this is what she was going to do. I went to a sewing academy to learn the techniques of clothing making. So I didn't go to designing school. I'm self-taught in that area. But I did study garment construction and selecting fabrics and pattern making and all that. I did go to, school.
I've been reading a little bit about your background, and I believe I understand that at that same time, you also went to work, hard work, in a sweatshop or two. Can you tell us about that experience?
Yeah, well, that was very common in Honduras, and it's not as much anymore because the factories have left and have moved mostly to Asia. But in the late 80s and the beginning of the 90s, that was very common, that girls will work in the factories and sweatshops, as they're called here, because there was this boom in manufacturing. And you go there and you work in these places. It was just, nothing uncommon to see.
And was that in sewing, in putting together pieces of clothing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was more like a quality inspector, that I would get to see the garments and make sure that all the parts and, the process was being done correctly. But for the most part, I was a sewer. I was sitting all day sewing.
So when did you first realize that you wanted more, that you wanted to pursue a career as somebody who was designing the clothes, not putting them together?
Well, I always designed clothes. I always made the clothes that I would wear to special events. And sometimes, they were a little weird considering what was going on and the styles there. And when people tell you, oh, that's interesting, they're really not getting what are you wearing. But I also make clothes for my friends. And working in the factories, I learned a lot. But after being there for, almost 6 years, it was too much for me to deal with, because I've always been a very creative and social person. And the schedule in the factories, it was super intense. And I also wasn't able to do the things that I want to do, like do community work and do creative things. And so I left that and moved back to live with my grandfather in La Mosquitia, which is the area where I met Chris. And so after I moved to the States is when I started pursuing doing more creative work.
You are known for using unconventional materials in your designs. Tell us about that and maybe give us an example.
Yeah, like I say, I always made things growing up, and I really didn't have access to too much resources. And so that kind of pushed me into just, using whatever was available. And so I have made dresses out of plastic bags, newspapers, tarp, three bars, I don't know, so many different things. I collect things, and I always have an idea in mind that what I'm going to do with it. And it takes me time to collect the materials. And when I have them, just put them together. But it's like it was out of necessity. But now that I know that we need to be more aware of what type of materials we use and take into consideration the environmental impact of everything that we do, I do it more on purpose. I'm I'm more intentional about it. But before it was just because I just couldn't afford to purchase materials.
When you're designing something, are you designing it externally? And by that, I mean how it looks. Or are you thinking about how it's going to feel to be in it, how a woman is going to feel wearing that item?
It depends. If you're doing creative work, practicality is not the main thing, you know. You just want to create something that is original, that is dramatic, that gets people attention. If you're working with a client, because I do mostly custom work, and then, yeah, you have to think more in functionality and also how it's going to feel. And I have to talk to my clients to get what is that they're looking for or what the aesthetic they're going for. So yeah, it just changes based on the type of project that I'm working on.
We're talking with Lexington fashion designer Sarita Benedict Begley, and I want to ask you, what fascinates you right now, and how does that feed into what you do?
Oh, what fascinates me right now is just people coming out and trying to find their own identity. And I feel like fashion has a lot to do on that, like, you know, trying to figure out who you are, where you stand, and so many issues, political, religious, social issues. People sometimes don't realize how aesthetic or the way that we look reflects a lot of where we stand and so many issues. And I see that a lot now, you know, and especially like places in social media and Instagram and with the youth, like how they're really coming through and trying to show who they are and what are their beliefs. And I have two teenage kids, and I see that with them and with their friends. And it's pretty interesting because for some time we went into this kind of like a steady way of being, that there was not so much controversy around some issues, but now there's so much political issues being talked about, and that influenced how fashion is managed as well. And economically speaking, when there is more poverty, people tend to wear clothes that are, you know, very more quiet, very passive, don't want to draw too much attention to themselves. And when there is a little more of a economic gain, people tend to, you know, be more over the top and more dramatic with what they wear. So it's fascinating to see that from artistic perspective and analyzing what you see, the images you see in magazines and movies and all that.
I know that you've traveled all over the United States, all around the world for that matter, and you've been speaking on issues such as fair trade, women's and minorities' rights, sustainable development. Is there a connection between your art and your activism?
Absolutely. My activism kind of keeps my art going. I don't think that I will be doing this work as much or even doing it at all if it wasn't for my passion to educate the public about the reality of the fashion industry beyond the magazines and the runway shows. Because not so many people have had the opportunity to transition from being a sweatshop worker to become a designer, you know? And so I'm like, this is a unique opportunity that I have to educate what's happening right now at the border has something to do with the clothing industry, the people that were mobilized in Honduras from the countryside to work in the factories, and how they were so poor, they didn't have enough to feed their families, they had to go somewhere else, and how all these things are connected. And so for me, are totally, totally connected, and I try to highlight that constantly.
A couple more fashion questions. I don't want to get to the event that you have coming up, but a couple of things that have always kind of puzzled me. Fashion seems to always evolve and always mm-hmm. change. How do you anticipate that next big thing? How do you stay ahead of that curve?
Well, you know, I see fashion from a different perspective. I try to promote more personal style than fashion. I'm against fast fashion, which has created so many economic, social, and environmental issues. And so I have an aesthetic that I like, and I try to stick to it. Like, a lot of people are able to recognize my style easily if they see it. And so I'm not so much on trying to come up with the next big thing. I'm just want to create things that are beautiful, that make people happy, and that they're exciting. And yeah, they can be innovative at times. But for the most part, I just want to create beauty. You know, I want to utilize this creativity and the skills that I have to make people happy.
We'll have some images of your work on our website on eswek.com. And there's an opportunity coming up to see them in person. And I understand that's happening on January 24th at UK, correct?
That's correct. Yeah, I was invited to showcase my work, also do a talk related to issues of immigration. The Department of Arts and Science has this project that they've been doing for a while. It's called Passport to the World. And each time they dedicate this event to a specific topic, and in this case is the year of immigration. And so they seem to think that, you know, I can do a good job with that. And so they invite me to do a talk and also to showcase a collection in a runway. So yeah, that'll be happening on the 24th, and it's a free event open to the public.
We're in a moment with a lot of attention being paid to the border.
Yes.
And many of those who've been caught up in that have come from Honduras.
Correct.
Do you hear from family in Honduras, friends, people that you know who have related to you, what's driving people to make that dangerous trek?
Yeah, of course. It's mainly poverty and the violence that, you know, that we're suffering in Honduras. And people have lost so much, starting with losing access to land that is, you know, easy to maintain. And climate change also has impacted the economic situation in Honduras. And then in 2009, when there was a coup, that it was not called a coup, but it was, for us it was, with the removal of a president who was very liberal and very forward, with had great ideas, you know, trying to double the minimum wage, and he was trying to do so many things, and he was pushed out and replaced with more conservative and in the oppressive system, and has created this, and also the war on drugs has affected security in our country. There is just so much violence and gangs and all this stuff that people have no choice but to leave, because if they stay, they're very likely to be killed or just starve because they don't have access to any economic opportunities. And yeah, and that's what happens. You know, people are going to try to go to where they think that things going to be better for them and for their children, of course.
Okay, back to a little bit more on fashion. What is your favorite part about being a designer?
Well, I get to materialize my ideas. You know, not all ideas can be seen physically, and you can share that with people. And for the most part, people are very interested and curious about fashion. You know, they have this whole perception of being something glamorous and exciting, and they're very interested. So it hasn't been hard for me to be able to find supporters and people who want to be a part of what I do. I feel extremely blessed and lucky to be able to be here in Lexington, with people who have great interest in what I'm doing. And so it is very exciting to be connected with something that I love so much, and connect that to other people. Sometimes it's people who have the same interest in doing, but also people who just want to admire.
Fashion designer Sarita Benedict Begley, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much. It's my pleasure.
What's it like to find yourself in a place where no one understands what you're saying and you can't understand what they're saying? Learning to speak and understand English, a language full of confusing sound-alikes, there, and there, or two, two, and two, or here, and here. Learning this language of ours is one of the first big obstacles refugees encounter when they arrive in America. Rhonda Miller of member station WKYU has word of a program in Louisville that helps refugees who are 60 and older cross that language barrier.
How long has she been in the United States?
Ugize imyaka ingahe hano muri America?
Hano, pagize umwaka umwe n'amezi atanu.
1 year and 5 months.
So she came here when she was like 88 years old.
She was 89.
Interpreter Patrick Bagaza speaks with 90-year-old Therese Namuje during a trip with the Refugee Elder Program
to the Speed Art Museum in Louisville. The language is Kinyarwanda, and they're talking about how Namujes fled from the violence in her home country, Democratic Republic of Congo.
She was a refugee to a neighbor country, Rwanda, almost 20 years.
The museum trip is one of the many ways the Refugee Elder Program encourages better English language skills. The program is sponsored by Kentucky Refugee Ministries and funded by the U.S. Office of Refugee Resettlement.
Closes the window.
A major part of the Refugee Elder Program is offering English classes every Tuesday and Thursday in Louisville. Some refugees in the program speak several languages, like 63-year-old Jacqueline Belezi.
My first language is French and Swahili.
She learned some English when she was in a refugee camp in Uganda after she fled from the Democratic Republic of Congo.
Our country has many problems like war, kill people, kill innocent. And my husband was victim for killing in Congo. Yeah, killed.
The English classes also create a sense of community that can help refugees move forward from their many hardships.
Boy opens the door.
Retired banker Beth Clark is one of the English teachers and says most of the refugees are consistent about coming to class.
So we feel like we're doing something right, even if they don't learn a lot of English that really sticks with them. And some of them do learn and do graduate up from this class to the next level. But some don't and, you know, have come for years to the same class. And they're voluntarily coming, and we love to have them. And, you know, whoever they are, we try to do our best to make America feel like a friendly place to them.
D-E-F. Bonnie Lossie is a retired nurse and art therapist who's an English teacher with the program. She says she has one general goal for refugees who have to begin with the basics.
How to write their name and their address. So to do that, they have to learn the numbers and the alphabet.
Four.
That's Namagisha Namahoro, who's from Congo and whose native language is Kinyarwanda, with English teacher Kevin Marie Nuss.
40219.
Nuss says she's inspired by the refugees, especially after all the challenges they've endured.
These folks are all elders, so it just amazes me that some of these classes, these folks have never been in a school, and so they don't even have the letters or the numbers as a starting point. And so in their 70s, 80s, even early 90s, they're in a new country, completely different environment, trying to learn this drastically different language.
Nuss has learned to say sing in Swahili.
Learn to sing. Kwimba.
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 In Bowling Green, I'm Rhonda Miller.
Okay.
A, B, production of this story was supported by the Gerontological Society of America, Journalist Network on Generations, and the Silver Century Foundation.
Coming up after the break, meet our new content partner for Coverage of the Arts and a novel about corruption and heavy partying in Frankfurt. Our talk with the author, Phil Osborne. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Eastern Standard is made possible by One, the Alltech Ideas Conference. One is an incubator of innovation, a forum for future thinkers, and a platform for propelling forward the promise of a planet of plenty. Attendees view technology as a transformative opportunity for their businesses and lives in order to make a difference in the world. Learn more about 119 in Lexington, May 19th through the 21st, 2019, at one.alltech.com.
Major support for Eastern Standard on WEKU is provided by the law firm Hicks & Funson. Kentucky lawyers Josh Hicks, Greg Funson, and Shannon Church provide legal advice and representation in the areas of personal injury, catastrophic accident, and immigration law. Learn more at hfkylawyers.com. And now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
We're back, and this is one of those full disclosure moments. For the past 5 years, I've been in partnership with Christine Huskisson and Art Sheckett, producing the online cultural affairs magazine Undermain. It's an ad-free 501c3 and therefore a nonprofit in every sense of the word. We launched Undermain on the belief that Kentucky art needs all of the help and attention it can get. Art and Christine stopped by recently with some news, and that seemed like a good way to make some introductions.
Christine, Undermain had some really good, important news in 2018 and was awarded a grant by Great Meadows Foundation. Why don't you tell us something about what Great Meadows Foundation's purpose is, and then we can talk a little bit about the grant itself.
Great. Yeah, the Great Meadows Foundation is a grant-giving organization, and it was started by Al Shands, an arts patron, and his late wife, Mary, to support the work of visual artists in Kentucky.
So Undermain was awarded a grant of $5,000 by Great Meadows Foundation. Tell us about the purpose of the grant, why they awarded Undermain this grant and what its purpose is and what Undermain is supposed to do on their end to fulfill the terms of the grant.
Mm-hmm. The grant is really has two parts. The first is to pay credentialed writers for long-term critical essays about various visual artists in Kentucky. And we're looking forward to pairing some of the writers that already work with Undermain with various artists throughout Kentucky, and we will be paying them a little bit more for that work.
So these are going to be in-depth pieces that Undermain's going to publish about Kentucky artists.
That is correct, and we have the opportunity to do that 12 years, one per month in 2019.
So this will really be a deep dive into the work of 12 Kentucky-based artists.
That is true, and we are reaching out into Northern Kentucky and Louisville and the Central Kentucky region, essentially.
And there'll be studio visits along with that, isn't that correct?
That is true, and we have the first one lined up, I believe, with Dr. Emily Elizabeth Goodman from Transylvania University. She will be visiting with Melissa Vandenberg.
Now, she is on the faculty at Eastern Kentucky University, isn't she?
That is correct.
Oh, that's great. Mm-hmm. That's great. Her work is very interesting. I'm very familiar with it. And I think that'll be a terrific piece. Now, there's another piece to the grant, too, in terms of reviews of shows.
That will continue. You know, Undermain, as you well know, mm-hmm. Undermain has been doing that for quite some time. We pay writers at all stages of their careers, and that will continue for shorter kind of critical review essays to, I guess, further really the work of many more artists.
So Great Meadows grant really is helping Undermain really further their platform as a place to publish writing about art.
That is true. Criticism has been one of our goals or part of our mission for a long time. And if we can advance that discourse, I think it helps raise the bar for everyone.
There's a companion piece, a live event companion piece to this grant too, Critical Mass 3. This is the third in a series of live events that Undermain has produced. Why don't you tell us something about Critical Mass 3?
That is true. The first thing you should probably know is that it is a matching grant to what we've received from the Great Meadows Foundation, and this money will help us put on Critical Mass 3 titled In the Mid, Regionalism in the Arts, and this one will be held up in the Carnegie Center in Northern Kentucky, and it's really primarily being directed by Matt Distel, who is the director there.
And what's the focus of that event going to be?
The focus of that one is about how artists in this region deal with the fact that we are in the middle, sort of in this regionalism, if you will, not on either end in the larger art centers. And that, you know, raises some concerns and some specific issues for certain artists. And we hope to discuss some of those a little bit further. This conversation started with Critical Mass 2 and Dan Cameron in Louisville at the KMAC Center.
Dan Cameron's a renowned art critic and curator,
who was also the first critic in residence for the Great Meadows Foundation. This year, on March 15 and 16, Natalia Zuluaga will be the primary critic in residence, basically our featured panelist.
So that's going to be Great Meadows Artist in Residence is Natalia Zuluaga.
Correct.
And she's going to be part of Critical Mass 3.
That is correct.
And will that be an event open to the public?
Oh, yes, absolutely. We do require reservations just so we have some idea. Critical Mass 2 was so successful. There were nearly 80, 85 people there, and we're hoping to increase that audience.
And there'll be more about this event on the Undermaine website, under-maine.com, will, as the details fill in about this event, Undermaine will publish those on its website.
That web address again is under-maine.com. So first up in Undermaine's contributions to Eastern Standard is Christine Huskisson's conversation with Matt Collinsworth. He's the Lexington Art League's brand new interim director.
Tell us a little bit about you. How did you become interested in art?
I became interested in art broadly when I was in college. I read James Wright's poem, Autumn Begins in Martins Ferry, Ohio, and said, hey, I can do that, want to try to do that, and became a poet. I got into the visual arts in graduate school while working at the Wexner Center at Ohio State, and continued to delve further into the visual arts when I became the director of the Kentucky Folk Arts Center in Moorhead back in 2003.
Yeah, you were the director there for quite some time. And tell us a little bit about that center and the collection and why it's so unique.
The collection there was very special. It's the it's a collection of about 1,500 pieces. When I left this summer, that's where it was, of self-taught art from all over Kentucky. Kentucky, as people may or may not know, is a hotbed for self-taught art in America. One of the three, along with the Deep South, Mississippi Delta region, and the American Southwest. And it was a collection that was wonderful. Had 70 or 80 masterpiece level works in it. And we did a lot of traveling exhibitions that toured the nation over the years. And it was a special place.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like that experience has really moved you into your new position now as interim executive director of the Art League. What was it that appealed to you about coming to the Art League?
I think the thing that appealed most to me was the ability to be creative at the same time while being thinking analytically and strategically about a lot of things as we made changes to the Art League's programs. Right now, I think for 2019, we have a very exciting slate of programs coming up.
Yeah, we're hoping you'll tell us a little bit more about that.
Yes. In the past, the Art League's done maybe 4 to 6 major shows a year, full rehangs of the Loudon House. We're sort of shifting things around this year. We're breaking down our spaces into separate galleries. This coming year, we're doing 22 to 24 new exhibitions, primarily focused on solo shows by Lexington area artists. Solo shows are great for artists. It's, I think, a better opportunity for them than participating in group shows. And it also allows the art-loving public to delve a little bit deeper into the artist's work. So we're getting ready to launch those very soon.
Can you name the series, Matt? I think there's a 3 or 4.
Yes, we've got 4 exhibitions opening on January 18th. Our signature series exhibition, which will come with a catalog, is an exhibition by Clay Wainscott called Return from Exile. Then we have 2 other solo shows, one by Benjamin Sally, who's a young painter who recently relocated to Lexington from Louisiana. And the other one is Susan Deaton, who taught high school art for many years here in Lexington, does some really interesting pen and ink work. And the 4th show is a group show curated by Samantha Simpson, who works as the gallery director at Georgetown College. And she has a show called Aurora. It's has a lot to do with color. It features artists like Adrian Dixon, Lori LaRusso, Natalie Baxter, and John Norris.
Yeah, it sounds like a good opportunity for many. I know there are also some challenges, major challenges maybe at the Lexington Art League. Can you tell us anything about its immediate future?
I think the challenges that we're facing are similar to those faced by lots of other cultural organizations around the country. We're constantly seeking support in terms of members and sponsors for our programming. And we're not sure where the national economy is going right now with the gyrations in the market and changes to the tax code and how that affects donors. But finances for a small cultural organization are always the top challenge.
Absolutely. And why do you think folks in Lexington should care about the Art League?
I think if Lexington wants to continue to become a hub for cultural activities in our broader region and a cultural destination for visitors, the Lexington Art League is the type of place that's going to not only support the visual artists who are already here, but we're also going to draw new artists to the community. We're going to make the culture of the city more vibrant, as well as making the economy more vibrant. And that's something that should concern everyone who lives in the Lexington area.
Matt Collingsworth is interim director of the Lexington Art League. Thanks, Matt.
Thank you.
Following 7 years as a broadcast journalist, Phil Osborne has been in the public affairs and political arenas for more than 35 years. According to this EKU graduate and Carter County native, he's been following politics since his maternal grandfather cussed at and about Burt Combs, Ned Breathitt, and Happy Chandler back in the early 60s. He claims to be one of the few non-politicians to have visited all 120 Kentucky counties. All of that experience and exposure to state and local government and politics has inspired his first novel, Flight 668. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Phil.
Thank you, Tom. Pleasure to be here.
So first, the title, Flight 668. How did you arrive at the title, Flight 668?
Well, it's really unrelated to the storyline, but it's the flight that one of the characters is taking home on a connecting flight from Atlanta back to central Kentucky. So that's just where the title popped up.
And you've described the book to me as a story of power and politics in our state capital. And you were, for many years, the Osborne of the Lexington public relations firm Preston Osborne, but you also spent some time in Frankfort, is that right?
Correct. I was involved with broadcast news for 7 years coming out of college, but I was also involved in the Steve Beshear campaign when Steve was first elected governor.
Okay, knowing that you were in Frankfort and reading your book, you can't help but wonder, were you taking notes? Should anybody be worried?
Nobody should be worried about it. Their names changed to protect the innocent. No, seriously, it's just a result of 40 years of observation of what goes on in Frankfort, the good, bad, and the ugly. No names are named, and they're not based on any specific characters, just lots of stories and storylines that evolved over the years.
It's a pretty steamy book. The bourbon flows freely. There's lots of sex, lots of moral compromising and political corruption. And as I mentioned, you were in Frankfort for a time. Are you trying to tell us something here?
Well, read the headlines from the past several years, and you can get a sense that what I tell folks, it's not PG-13, but neither is Frankfort. So that's kind of, it's not an expose on anyone or any particular party, any particular person. It's just, again, stories that have built up over the years that are manifested in one book.
We're talking about this tale of debauchery and political chicanery in and around Frankfort at a time when the 2019 Kentucky General Assembly just happens to be gaveled in. As we read Flight 668, should we wonder what might be going on behind the scenes down there?
Well, again, I think you can go back and look at the headlines from the past several years and get an idea of what goes on outside the chambers. It's an unfortunate fact, but it is a fact. What I suggested to folks this year, both in Kentucky and elsewhere, is read a couple of chapters each day while the legislature's in session and just see how much fiction and fact are melded together.
Check me if I'm wrong, but most of the women portrayed in Flight 668 seem to be there for the pleasure of powerful men.
At first glance, it looks like that, but if you look at the entire plot line, the three strongest characters are all women. There's the lieutenant governor, there's the FBI agent, and then, two of the heroines of the book. Both turn out to be very strong women. So I'm not trying to, subjugate women to a lesser role at all, because I think, in the scheme of things, you'll find that the women are actually the strongest characters and the heroines of the story.
I think a lot of people imagine writing a book about the things that they've seen and experienced in life, but very few of us actually sit down and do it. What got you there?
That's an interesting question. I was just at a point in my life where I wanted to do something different. I've been practicing public relations for 40 years, and although I still enjoy it, it's not the challenge that it once was. And I've always wanted to write. I've used writing as a tool in my public relations career. I actually started my first book when I was in college and never finished it. But this one, I started writing myself notes, and I started developing characters in my mind. And after my wife would go to sleep, she's a school teacher, she's in bed by 9 o'clock, I'm bored, I don't want to watch TV. So I sat down in front of the computer and wrote a book.
Organizing a story from beginning to end, and the plot has to flow, it has to end up someplace, yours has a kind of a cool twist on the very end. You have to be thinking about those things. Is that a big challenge?
It is a challenge, and I've gone back at certain points and rewritten earlier chapters to fit with the new direction that I come up with. And actually, the final twist that you alluded to was not there in the original book. Hmm. I gave it to my wife. She enjoyed it, but said there's still something missing here. So the last chapter, which was the original epilogue, became the last chapter with a new epilogue. And that's where the twist comes that you were referring to.
For somebody else out there that might be thinking about doing this, about writing a book, was it a challenge to self-publish?
Not at all. Amazon and a subsidiary of Amazon, now called Kindle Publishing, actually makes it very easy. I did go to the extent of having a graphic designer work on a cover. The book that you had is a cover that I designed, which I'll flat say is abysmal. But the new book has a professional cover. But the publishing part of it itself is you upload it, they test it, they print it, and you can order on demand. So it's not like you have to print 1,000 copies at a time.
So you're going to write another one?
I am. I've already started work on it.
Oh, can you give us a hint?
It involves the energy industry, which I also know a little bit about, and some twists and turns on the energy companies that are throughout the United States.
So. All right. Look forward to it. Phil Osborne is the author of the novel Flight 668, A Story of Power and Politics in Our State Capitol. And another full disclosure, Phil works for WEKU in underwriting sales.
What they do, they smile in your face.
All the time they want to take your place, the backstabbers.
Backstabbers, they smile in your face.
All the time they want to take your place, the backstabbers.
Backstabbers.
A change of plans. Last week we mentioned that State Tourism Commissioner Kristen Branscombe would appear in this edition. We talked with her about how realistic it is to imagine tourism as an economic savior for Eastern Kentucky. Well, some other stories from the region have since come in, so we decided to hold our chat with Kristen for that show, which is coming up next week. You'll also hear from Herald Leader Eastern Kentucky reporter Bill Eastep on the towns of Benham and Lynch and concerns there about nearby surface mining. Morehead State University Associate Professor of History Thomas Kiffmeyer on his book, Reformers to Radicals, The Appalachian Volunteers and the War on Poverty. Plus another in our monthly feature, Humans of Central Appalachia. That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is a broadcast service of Eastern Kentucky University, produced in the Lexington studios of Dynamics Productions, with the support of One, the Altec Ideas Conference, a global nexus of innovation for the future of food and the farm. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and editor. We're online at esweku.com. You can listen to all WEKU programming live and archived anytime, anywhere by downloading the WEKU app from your iPhone, Android, or Google App Store. Eastern Standard is available as a podcast. You'll find us on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. Have a comment, a suggestion, or an idea? You can put it in an email and send to es@eku.edu, or you can leave brief voicemail at 859-904-8021. That's 859-904-8021. Let us know if we have your permission to replay your remarks on the air. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.